Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 2:19 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is Thursday, and it is April 14th. But tomorrow is Good Friday, and it's a long weekend. So I'm going to do the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes today. And I've been thinking about markets, and well, I guess how's that different from any other day? But what I've been thinking about is how does the Federal Reserve look at markets? Because we know that they use the stock market as a barometer for how the economy is performing, and perhaps more correctly, the effectiveness of monetary policy. So when the stock market is only a couple of percent down from its all-time high, well, then they're obviously thinking about that they've got room. They've got plenty of space in which to raise rates and to withdraw liquidity and reduce the size of the balance sheet because the stock market really hasn't reacted. If we just simply think about how much is the S&P 500 down, well, we can just simply see it on the World Equity Index page. So the Dow Jones for the year is down 4%, the S&P down 7.5%, and the Nasdaq Composite down 14%. Well, that alone just tells us how interest rate sensitive growth and technology shares are compared to the wider stock market and particularly blue chippy type companies in the Dow. But when you're the Federal Reserve and you're looking at panic at the long end of the curve, and again, they're going to be looking at the number of basis points that the 10-year yield has moved just this year, because it was at 150 basis points and now it's at 280. So we're up 130 basis points in the space of about 3.5 months. So there's world-beating or record-beating figures that are coming out in terms of CPI and PPI. And used car figures have been surging and just started to come off this week. The rental figures continue to ramp higher. And then you are also starting to see that the cost of food is exploding on the upside, hitting new all-time highs. When you're an economist and you don't look at charts and you just look at percentages and you just look at numbers, and you're thinking about, well, how much leeway do I have to raise interest rates? Well, they're going to look at how much the stock market is down and think, well, the stock market investor isn't particularly worried about the prospect of raising interest rates. So that's going to encourage them to raise interest rates more. And of course, that's what the bond market is worried about. So if you're a stock market investor, how are you looking at the markets? You're looking at the market and saying, well, golly, nobody seems to be panicking. And what's happening in the bond market seems to be an overreaction because the Federal Reserve rides to the rescue every single time there's a pullback. And the defining characteristic of the strength of this bull market over the course of the last decade has been the willingness of investors to look past the decline and price in the recovery before the decline. And that's exactly what's going on right now, because stock market investors are thinking, well, the Nasdaq has pulled back sharply because interest rates are going up. And banks might be rolling over because interest rates and yields are rising. But it's so inevitable that if the stock market were to pull back by 20%, then the Fed would ride to the rescue because that's what they did in 2018. And they've been doing that every time the stock market has pulled back sharply since 1987. So, and there's a good reason. I mean, when you look at the number of instances that that has already happened, well, if you're a stock market investor, you'd have to be thinking that there's no real need to sell, because the Fed's bound to ride to the rescue. So this is an interesting discussion, because on the one hand, you have the bond market flipping out at the prospect of inflation getting out of control. And then you have the stock market, which is benefiting both from its status as a safe haven against inflation, because companies can raise prices and they can buy back their shares and they can increase their dividends. So they offer some protection against inflation. They certainly offer more protection than long-dated bonds. And I thought it was interesting in here this week as well. You had Jeff Gundlach talking about the potential for a recession, but I thought one of the really impre or the one of the things that he said that really stood out to me was, "Who wants to be a bond king today?" Because all parts of the bond market are selling off. So the 3-month yield is now up to 75 basis points. So it has priced in another 25 basis point hike within the next 3 months, but the market has already priced in 50 basis points. So within the next week or two, it should be up to about 1%. By that time, it's quite likely that the 10-year will be up to 3%. And this is, I think it is inevitable that you have to have the pullback before central banks will relent. So when I was saying earlier on this year that I thought that the Federal Reserve would do one and done, that they'd raise rates once and they wouldn't be able to raise them again, it was based on the assumption that we were going to have a good-sized pullback in stock markets before they had a chance to raise rates again. And now let's look at the Nasdaq on a weekly chart, because it's leading on the downside and it has now encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. We had a good-sized downward dynamic last week and we followed through on the downside this week. And it looks like this is a type 2 top formation with right-hand extension. So we had a consistent trend on the way up. We had a really impressive bounce from the region of the 1,000-day moving average, a series of ranges, one above another, a very consistent trend all the way through until January of this year. Then it broke down, it triggered a midpoint danger line stop. Then it started to encounter resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. It steadied somewhat yesterday, gave it up in here today. And I think it is more likely than not that we're going to come back down and test the region of the 1,000-day moving average, which is another, I guess, 2,000 points and change decline from here, or potentially come down and test the big psychological 10,000 level, which would be a substantial pullback from the peak around 17,000 that we saw at the end of last year. And that is the kind of move that would certainly start to raise the alarm bells at the Fed and get people to start thinking about the potential that inflationary pressures have already peaked and that they should instead start thinking about how to support the economy. But they're not going to rush into that decision without evidence. If the stock market does not pull back like that before the decision to raise rates in May, then it's likely that they will raise by 50 basis points. And I think that is the kind of event that will trigger some difficulties in the stock market. Now, when we think about inflation, oil prices remain really very firm and bounced emphatically on Tuesday, followed through on the upside yesterday, and we're up another $2 in here today. So this is now looking like an upside weekly Q reversal and confirming at least near-term support in the region of the big psychological $100 area. Now, when we look at this chart, we've had a really impressive advance, up from 20 to 140. And that's really world beating, to go up 7 times in the space of 18 months is a really impressive performance. And we're seeing some consolidation right now. One of the biggest challenges with the oil price, and I think it's not something that's going to easily be fixed overnight, is that we have this environment where the global community has become complacent. This isn't the first time this has happened either. Because I remember growing up and learning about the wine lake and the butter mountain and the excess food production in Europe. And because of that low price of food, because of subsidies and the sense of inequality that it created versus the emerging markets and the third world, then the subsidies were dismissed and it was viewed as an opportunity for the emerging markets and the third world to become more dependent and to export commodities and to then raise the living standards of millions of poor people. And in many respects, it was successful. But what it in fact did was it greatly advantaged the most agriculturally productive areas, particularly Brazil. So Brazil did fantastically well from the reduction in subsidies and became what is effectively an agricultural superpower. And it was part of the bargain that because subsidies were removed, prices would be expected to rise. Now, we can think about natural gas, because natural gas prices have been going sideways for what feels like forever. And now they are breaking out above $7. Now, this is an almost identical environment, because if we look at the longer term chart, we had really spectacular volatility in 2005 through 2008. And then prices collapsed, and they haven't recovered until now. And 14 years of prices ranging in a volatile manner, but never surmounting $6, and then collapsing down to test the lows again, and natural gas being probably the only commodity that has come all the way back down and unwound all of the bull market from the early 2000s. That lulled people into a false sense of security that low natural gas prices were an inevitability that would last indefinitely. Well, one thing that low prices do is they encourage new sources of demand, particularly when prices are low relative to everything else. So natural gas became cost competitive with coal. So therefore it overcame coal because it's less polluting. The introduction of carbon credits made coal relatively more expensive, advantaged natural gas. Then the green lobby, looking at natural gas and thinking about how it was gaining popularity, then started to clamp down on pipelines, introduce more laws against natural gas flaring, and then greatly campaigned against additional drilling. And then investors are sick of losing money, so they're not willing to continue to support the market, and they want to see profits, so they're not going to continue to drill. And natural gas then also became a globally fungible commodity, and you now have global demand and international trading of what was once a domestic market. So now you're seeing new sources of demand, and we're going to see a levelizing of international pricing, which suggests that natural gas prices have the scope to rally significantly because arbitrages are going to be ironed out of this market over time. It means that there's going to be a significant call on natural gas, and that is a very clear base formation completion. And creating fungibility in markets is, I think, a very interesting development. Natural gas was always a North American commodity, a European commodity, and an Asian commodity, but those markets weren't interrelated, and now they're becoming interrelated. Now we can also think about diamonds, because diamonds have never been available to institutional clients. And the reason is that it was never a fungible market. You couldn't put two diamonds on the table and say that they were worth exactly the same. And diamonds went through a really profound bear market and peaked in 2011 and then bottomed around 2020. And we can just look at this chart on a line, and it gives us, I think, a better look at exactly what prices have been doing. Because we can go all the way back here to 2011 and also before it. So we have a price here for a 1 carat fine diamond, but at that 1 carat fine diamond is looking at the very, very best quality. And prices have recovered really impressively. They're up about 50% in the last year. But overall, the size of the moves isn't all that big, going from 100 to 200 in the space of about 3 years from the low in 2009. Because there hasn't been institutional investment, it's been retail focused. And then you had the campaign against conspicuous consumption in China and anti-corruption. And it had been the practice before about 2014 to give 1 carat diamonds as gifts among communist cadres in China. So that's pretty much over. And then it really pulled the rug out from under the market, and we had a really big decline after 2014. Well, Diamond Standard is now creating fungibility in diamonds. They are buying about 10,000 diamonds a month, and then they're putting them through a process of grading. And that grading is based on GIA certification. And then they come up with a cost curve, and they're making markets in these diamonds, so they have a real-time price. And then they take a sampling of the diamonds off that curve and create coins so that every coin is worth the same. And then they include a chip so that custody is easily tracked. Then the visual, or I guess because of every diamond is placed and every diamond is different within the coins, then they have a unique identity as well as having a chip. So then they're impossible to forge as well. And now they're starting to create a globally tradable market in diamonds. And there's more institutional ownership of Bitcoin than there is of diamonds today. And there is truly limited supply. And the diamond mining industry has been a terrible business for an awfully long time. If we look at the downtrend that we've had in the diamond markets over the course of the last decade, well, it's really weighed on some of the diamond shares. So Gem Diamonds in the UK has been trending downwards again for really a prolonged period and is at a fraction of where it was trading back in 2008, but it is just beginning to demonstrate some support. And then Petra Diamonds is also an interesting proposition here because it's not just at a fraction. It almost had a cataclysmic decline. So it's really just beginning to come up to the upper side of this base formation. And in 2017, it traded at 7,000, and we're now at 134. So despite the fact that it is more than double where it was at the end of last year, there's potentially here room for additional upside. Of course, through De Beers, Anglo American has a really significant ownership of diamonds. And if institutions start to come into this market and they start trading as a blockchain or an asset-backed blockchain, and this starts next year, it suggests that there's going to be an explosion in demand. And it's not like we're not in a really significant bull market for commodities. So if we think about the CRB index, it's ramping higher, and we're up 200% in the last year, and it's still marching higher. So commodities are doing this really spectacular post-crash run, and this is already bigger than the post-2008 rally, and we've clearly broken this very long downtrend. Now, it is quite normal to see commodities outperforming when we're late in the cycle. And I would say that we are late in the cycle. And inflationary pressures are rising. And this isn't something that's just going to go away, but it will ebb and flow. And if this is like the 1970s, well, we're going to have volatility. And we're going to have a great deal of interest in hedges against inflation. So gold prices continue to steady here around the $1,900 area. Now they're down a tad in here today, but this just looks like a consolidation in the region of the big psychological 2000. When we think about gold on a purchasing power parity basis, it's been consolidating below the peaks for most of the last 3 years and is really only just beginning to pop on the upside. And I think this is an important way of looking at gold because it does act as a hedge against the loss of purchasing power in fiat currencies. Now, when we think about what's going on in Russia and Ukraine, and how this all relates to the global monetary theme. We know that there is a massive amount of debt outstanding. And this is a global phenomenon. It's not simply that we have creditor nations and debtor nations. We have countries with massive debts and massive future obligations. And we have countries that are relatively better managed. In many respects, the emerging markets are in a better position today than many developed markets because they have demographics on their side. They still have large young populations, and that means that they haven't made all those big promises about pension benefits and social benefits to that young population yet. Whereas there are massive unfunded liabilities in North America and in Europe. And then China's growth has been funded with debt for most of the last decade. And 30% of the economy is the housing market. So we have not just got competition in terms of geopolitics. But the real competition isn't about basis. It's not about foreign exchange or even about fiscal deficits. It's about who is going to make or how are these debts going to be resolved. And it may ultimately come down to war because we have many different bases for money and how the value of money is considered, but ultimately it comes down to force. Whoever wins the war, the loser pays their debts, and they pay their debts by losing their competitive advantage in trade. They go through a profound asset depreciation. They go through a hyperinflation, and ultimately they come out the other end in a weakened state relative to the victors. And this is going to be the fate of whoever comes out the loser in this great power competition that we're looking at today. Because there are lots of different moving parts. And I guess our beat here is to look at crowd psychology and to look at how markets are reacting to events. So we know that 10-year yields are surging right now. They're coming up to the upper side of this range. They're almost at 3%. Back in 2018, there was a lot of worry that we were at the end of the big bull market in 10-year treasuries. And now, if we look at the performance of the total return index for bonds, it is well below the 1,000-day moving average, and it has never been below the 1,000-day moving average like this before. So we have at least some evidence to suggest that not only is this a big pullback, but that we are potentially at the end of what has been a phenomenally large bull market in debt. Now, we can also think about the consistency of this trend, and it does have ranges one above another. So we had a big rising range between 2005 and 7, and since then ranges one above another. And the upper side of the underlying range is at 2200, and we're rapidly approaching that right now. We have exceptionally oversold conditions. So the Federal Reserve then, and central banks around the world, they are going to be looking at all of this, looking at the massive sell-off at the long end of the curve, worries about inflation, and a stock market that's reasonably sanguine. And they're thinking about how do we stop this? How do we attempt to bring yields down? And they have a tool. It's not necessarily interest rates. Interest rates are a blunt force trauma instrument, and they kill off everything. Whereas reducing the size of the balance sheet primarily targets where liquidity has been most acutely contributing to overvaluation. And we know what's happened the last few times. So if we look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet today, it's at a new high of almost 9 trillion. They took 750 billion out of circulation between the beginning of 2018 and the third quarter of 2019. And during 2019, there was a lot of concern about deflation. We'd had a 10% pullback at the beginning of 2018, a 20% pullback at the end of the year. The plunge protection team was deployed. The Fed stopped raising interest rates in January of 2019. They abandoned their quantitative tightening program. Then the high yield market experienced stress. They had to inject over 400 billion into the repo market in September of 2019. That really was the end of the tightening program. By the time the pandemic hit, then we already were on the way to loosening policy because the threat of a recession was imminent, and they went into overdrive. And the one thing that we've seen on multiple occasions now is that whenever a big central bank tries to reduce the size of the balance sheet, they end up having to double it later. So the Fed took the size of the balance sheet below at 4 trillion and then had to rise it to 7 during the panic. Then we can think about the size of the ECB's balance sheet, because they were still, or at least they still had a hangover from their time as an offshoot of the Bundesbank back in 2012. So during the sovereign wealth crisis, they injected €1 trillion into the system, and that created or at least that rescued everybody in the Eurozone. And they were worried about inflation. They were worried about what this kind of money creation would do in terms of inflation. So they took it all back out. And over the course of 2 years, they took a trillion out of circulation. And by the time we got around to 2014, there were serious worries about deflation, Japanization of Europe, and they had to relent. And over the course of the next 3 years, the size of the balance sheet doubled. So now we have two examples of what happens when quantitative tightening is deployed. So therefore, it's quite likely that what we're going to have is a serious hit to demand, that by sucking all of the liquidity out of the system, that central banks are going to contribute to a problematic event at some point next year. Now, when we think about the total assets of central banks, there are two factors that contribute to this index rising or falling. The first is central bank activity in terms of adding or subtracting to their balance sheets. So that was a direct consequence of when the market started pulling back a few years ago. It was because central banks were reducing the size of their balance sheets, particularly the Federal Reserve. But because this index is rebased to US dollars, then the other big contributing factor to a change in its direction is the strength of the dollar. Now, it takes a long time for this chart to load, which is why the screen is still black, because it has a lot of calculations inside it for a long-term chart. But this index has pulled back by $500 billion in the course of the last 6 weeks. So this is the most meaningful pullback we've seen since at least 2018. And the Fed hasn't started reducing the size of the balance sheet yet. But the dollar index is now above 100. Every time it's been above 100 since 2015, it has failed. And when it fails, it does so in a dynamic manner. Therefore, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside as long as we don't get a big downward dynamic. The dollar will continue to rally for as long as the Federal Reserve is continuing to talk about raising rates and reducing the size of the balance sheet. In very simple terms, it's about supply and demand. And when they reduce the size of the balance sheet, it reduces the number of outstanding dollars, and therefore the existing dollars in the market become more valuable. So the dollar rallies. Then we have the fact that the market has priced in multiple interest rate hikes. And unless there's a significant drawdown on the stock market, then those interest rate hikes will happen. Now, as I said already, I'm short the Nasdaq. I think that we are going to have a pullback. I just don't believe that the dollar can continue rallying like this and bond yields can continue to rally without there being a knock-on effect for the outlook for stocks. But so far, we haven't had a very large pullback, and we don't have evidence of panicky environments in the stock market just yet. But until we do, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside for the dollar. But I think what's particularly interesting is that any time there's even a whiff that the bond market finds support or the dollar weakens, then the stock market rallies impressively. So what this tells us is that stock market investors are still very wedded to the buy the dip strategy. And there's a good reason for that, because buying the dip has been one of the most rewarding strategies for a decade. If you were a stock market investor and you were content to only own the largest eight technology shares, those that benefited most from the introduction of 4G. And you just held them, or I guess just to name them, it's Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Alphabet, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Nvidia, and Tesla. Well, if you had owned those shares between 2012 and 2022, then you would have outperformed the market by a substantial margin. But this index of shares with their combined market caps has also rolled over. So we're in a rather interesting situation here, that liquidity conditions are beginning to tighten, and this is having a knock-on effect. Now, one of the things that really does start to create warning shots for the global economy is when high-yield spreads start moving through 500 basis points. So we had that in 2015, and we had that in 2020, but we haven't really seen a big spike since 2008. But every time we start moving through 500 basis points, it creates a problem in the market. We definitely saw that at the end of 2018, and that was why we started to see significant action to support markets and to reduce, or to begin reducing interest rates. So we've had some moderation in high yield spreads over the course of the last few weeks, but it's still an uptrend overall. Now, as we can see as well from this chart, it tends to be spiky. So the trend alone is a warning signal because it can surge on a weekly basis. And we have to pay attention to the fact that the spread might not be rising very quickly, but there's a clear downtrend in high yield bonds, and there's an equally clear downtrend in treasuries. So this is certainly meaningful that we have these very severe declines. And historically, bond markets tend and credit markets lead the stock market. So they are responding to tighter credit overall. Now, when we think about banking sectors, Goldman Sachs came through today with outsized bond market trading earnings, and the S&P 500 banks index was in negative territory, so it has completely unwound its overbought condition relative to the 1,000-day moving average, and it's testing the upper side of the underlying big trading range. But the problem here is that some of the ways that banks make money are disappearing. So mortgage rates are up to 5%, but it's not just the nominal value is important. The mortgage rate now is higher than it has been in a decade. Well, banks make money from borrowing short term and lending long term. So when you've got a flat yield curve or an inverted yield curve, that's no longer a profitable business. And then they also make money when interest rates are falling because they get to charge money to people for refinancing their mortgages. Well, nobody in their right mind is going to refinance into a 5% mortgage unless they absolutely have to. So that's also reducing the profit potential of banks in their very classic businesses. So they might be making money on the trading arm of the businesses, but they're losing it in other parts of the market. And I've seen I got an email yesterday from JP Morgan telling me that they had raised the fees for using ATMs that aren't their own from $2.50 to $3. So we're definitely seeing these kinds of events having an impact on the profitability of banks that they have to start raising fees in other parts of the business. Now, obviously, this is also withdrawing liquidity. And I think it was particularly relevant that when we look at the NASDAQ Global Banks Index, it has got this exceptionally lengthy base formation, and it got all the way up to test the upper side of it, but now it's failing and pulling back down again. So this isn't a particularly inspiring chart, and it suggests that the Global Banks Index is still very much within its base formation. Now, when we look at the European banking sector, it had been looking really quite favorable all the way through until the beginning of the war, and then it's now distributing below the 200-day moving average. So we have this massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And this is a type 2 top formation characteristic. So we have a lot of these type 2 top characteristics in Europe. And now it brings us back to the big question, because Europe has massive outstanding debts. And Europe has a banking sector that's been struggling to be recapitalized. And Europe also is in this sort of odd position that they're not quite a unified country. They have a unified monetary system, and they have governments that still very much act in their individual interests. And you have the potentially seismic repercussions of Marine Le Pen winning the French presidential election. And what would that mean for European cohesion and the ability, or I guess the subsuming of national interests into the European whole? And would that help to reverse it? It's a really profound question, but the banking sector certainly doesn't look healthy. When we think about the world from Russia's perspective, well, they are a major commodity exporter. And they've been looking around the world at how Russia's been losing influence for decades. And they've obviously have a feeling of lost grandeur. And there's interesting maps circulating showing the world from a Russian perspective because of the size of the country and the large number of countries on its border and the threatened feeling that they must have. But the problem with looking at the world from Russia's perspective is that it avoids the rights of the individual. And ultimately, when we think about what the differences are between governance systems, from a market's perspective, it is all about property rights and particularly minority shareholder interests. An independent judiciary and a free press. And if you've got all of those, well, then you can have confidence that when you make an investment, then you might be able to sell it at some point in the future and take your money out. And if you're defrauded for any reason, you have recourse to the courts and you have the potential to publicize injustices regardless of where they originate if you have a free press. Well, countries like Russia and China don't have any of those things. Now, they have big markets, and they dominate at very significant portions of the global economy. But that's not quite the same thing as whether investing there will be a profitable enterprise. Now, valuations in Russia were low before they invaded, so they're a lot lower now. And if one were to bet that the war will end soon, then taking positions in Russian assets, particularly from a country that's outside of sanctions, would probably be a good idea. But of course, if we're just at the beginning of a wider conflict between freedom of choice and individuality and free press versus authoritarianism, well, then that's a very different discussion. And it would mean that investing in China or investing in Russia is going to carry very significant negative repercussions for one's wealth, because sanctions can last for really prolonged periods of time. But we definitely tend to think of the world from a US or a European perspective. And I think that Saudi Arabia is an interesting case study, because I was over there in January and I got to speak with a lot of different people. But you're never going to hear what people really think when they don't know you. But you can keep your eyes open for what's notable. Well, I didn't meet any Russian people when I was in Saudi Arabia, but I met a lot of Chinese people. And I met three different individuals, and I only met three people working for the public investment fund, but they were all Chinese. And one was the chief economist, and another was the COO. So we certainly have evidence that Saudi Arabia is looking to where it can sell its products. And China is an awfully big customer. Now, is there the potential that China will develop as an entwined an agreement with Saudi Arabia as the USA and negotiate with Saudi Arabia to sell or to buy oil in renminbi? And it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility, because China buys Russia, the Saudi Arabian oil, and the USA doesn't. And that's probably not going to change. And we're in an environment today where oil is by far the most important commodity. But there are unintended consequences. So when we think about Russia invading Ukraine, that's encouraging countries like Finland and Sweden to consider joining NATO. Now, that's an unintended consequence from Russia's perspective. They would certainly not be comfortable with that, but they probably thought of it as a potential outcome and something that they could probably live with since they already have something of a missile defense in Kaliningrad. What happens if what we now see is a much greater focus on renewable energy, so that the role of oil in the global economy becomes less important, and we move away from the petrodollar system, that oil loses its capacity to be a really powerful monetary measure because of renewable energy? Now, we're not there yet, and this isn't something that happens overnight, and it's not relevant today because we have shortages. We have oil prices that are ramping higher. We have natural gas prices that are breaking on the upside, and there's a scramble on to try and source supply. And Italy this week negotiating with Algeria to get more gas. There have been discussions underway between Algeria and Germany for at least the last 15 years about putting in high tension power cables under the Mediterranean and building massive solar farms in the Sahara. Well, it is a lot more likely that that kind of infrastructure is going to get built now than it was 6 months ago. And obviously, there are going to be big changes involved, and there will have to be a ton of money spent. And if that ton of money spent can reduce the reliance on oil and create energy independence, well, then it'll be money well spent. But then we lose the lodestone, or the focal point of the global monetary system, because oil has been produced in some countries, used everywhere, totally globally fungible, and it becomes a less important commodity. Now, that is potentially one of the end games. And of course, the USA is a major producer of oil and an exporter of oil. Now, it is not as big an exporter of oil as Russia is or Saudi Arabia is, but it used to be the biggest consumer. So then this talk about the loss of the dollar as a reserve currency. It's a less of a reserve currency today than it was a decade ago. And a decade from now, the foundation of what a reserve currency will be is likely to be different as well. We're going to have to see massive investment in alternative sources of commodities, and not just production, but also processing. So, innovation in processing of metals to make them less dirty is going to be a really significant development. Now, we've seen a degree of that in steel production. The migration towards the electric arc furnace and the creation of a scrap trading system has greatly reduced the carbon emissions of the steel production system. But it hasn't eliminated it. And I think it is likely that we're going to see similar types of operations evolve in just about all of the metals. But this globalized market, where the lowest cost producer, the most efficient and just in time supply chains, that's just not going to be feasible and is going to require a massive reorientation. And it isn't going to come cheap. So, therefore, efficiency gains are going to be the primary, I think, investment opportunity for the foreseeable future, where we're going to have technology, and there are massive innovations occurring in real time in artificial intelligence, in big data, and those will deliver significant savings and productivity gains. And the innovation that we're getting in the healthcare sector is equally important. One thing that I think is particularly relevant is the biotech ETF has basically been absolved of its reliance on the vaccine producers. And it's now starting to find support around the upper side of the underlying trading range. And there is really the capacity for massive innovation in this sector, and most particularly in the invention of cures. Because one thing that we know is we're spending a ton of money on healthcare, and most of it goes towards treating chronic conditions. What we need are cures, and that's not a great business model for the companies producing, but it's certainly beneficial for society. And when you have a great need, then you start to get solutions. And genetic solutions to chronic conditions is certainly possible as debt loads become problematic. When we think about the wider technology sector, there's going to be a massive change. We've gone through a decade where there wasn't a discount rate and interest rates were falling. So even companies that didn't really have any real route to profitability, but had a really good route to creating market share, they did fantastically well. And that's only possible because of access to cheap liquidity. But we just don't have cheap liquidity any longer. So this is obviously something that is going to change. We're going to have a much greater focus on growth that can create income. So that's certainly true for some of the pharmaceutical companies. We're going to have a great deal of interest in the mining sector. So miners, they don't respond quickly to rising prices, and they're now being managed in a much more conservative fashion. So cash flows are accruing to the balance sheet, dividends are increasing, they're sporadically also buying back shares. And we're looking at the potential that there's going to have to be a massive boom in spending for the mining sector globally. And we're going to see a significant divergence in terms of the global supply chains. And that's going to create duplication. And because we're duplicating whole supply chains, then that's inefficient and it's going to contribute to inflation and rising prices. So we've had a profound move already in bond yields. And I do suspect that quantitative tightening will create deflationary fears and we'll start to see bond yields coming back down. But it doesn't mean that they're going to come all the way back down, or that inflation will be completely vanquished. Instead, I suspect that, and we can kind of think about this in terms of the yield curve, that we had a very lengthy period where the yield curve tightened. And it tightened for more than a decade, and it was one of the longest cycles in history. And then we had a sharp pop on the upside and a very swift contraction. What this says to me is we're in a period now where we should anticipate that we're going to have short, sharp cycles. And we'll have very powerful inflationary trends for brief periods of time, maybe a year or two at a time. Then we'll have growth scares and inflation will moderate. But the total debt won't get managed effectively. And any move to further increase the monetary supply will create a surge in inflationary pressures again, so that we move into a choppy uptrend of volatile inflationary measures. And this is going to be exacerbated then because of the volatility. Year-over-year comparisons are going to be all over the place. Ultimately, we're in the end game for this quantity of debt. We're in a situation where Japan led in terms of the size of its balance sheet, the quantity of debt outstanding, and the inability to raise rates. Europe did the same thing. They tried to raise rates, couldn't, and have been locked at zero. The USA is now at the point where they're trying to raise rates. Total outstanding debt went up by 25% during the pandemic. Yields are now back at where they were before the pandemic, so the cost of servicing the debt has at least gone up by a quarter, if not more. And China is at an additional interesting point. At present, US Treasuries yield more than Chinese 10-year debt. And the renminbi is only just beginning to weaken. They haven't wanted to devalue the currency because they want to create a stable environment. But the economy is hurting because of the pandemic and the zero COVID determination. And then China is also encumbered with large quantities of debt and a housing market that is under stress. And they need to loosen policy. But if they start printing, then they're going to start to inflate. And they don't want to have an inflationary problem. So they're trying to tough it out in terms of accepting the negative consequences of growth slowing down without increasing assistance. And that's really a short-term solution. And eventually they'll have to start printing. So it looks increasingly likely that the renminbi will weaken rather than strengthen. Then, of course, it will raise the question, well, will then Saudi Arabia be willing to accept a devaluing currency? And would they be better off sticking with the USA? And will China have to pay rubles to buy Russian oil, or will they get to pay renminbi? So these are all important questions. The world is basically writing off the US dollar, but I just don't believe that the question is that plain and simple. And when we talk about commodities as the basis for economic value, I don't think that that really makes sense in a digital economy. And the world is moving closer to a digital economy where knowledge and the ability to harness the productive potential of your population is truly where the value in the economy resides. And liberal values are a better way of doing that than telling people what and how they can think. So, obviously, these are argumentative points, and nobody has really dominated this discussion over time. And that's why wars are important, because ultimately, wars decide who wins and whose viewpoint takes precedence. And when we think about the arms race that is evolving, where Russia is already fielding hypersonic missiles, where China has already demonstrated that it can shoot down satellites, where now we're starting to see technology where satellites can be thrown into space using what is effectively a discus. And that would greatly enhance the ability to launch multiple satellites at once or to launch hundreds of satellites in a day. So it's really not all that much of a reach to think that space is going to be a new theater for war, that there will be an arms race for space, for hypersonic missiles, which are first strike. And obviously, these are very important considerations. It means that geopolitical tensions are going to be higher. There will be intense demand for commodities as a result of that. It suggests that we are moving into a secular bull market for commodity demand. And the drive towards building a completely separate infrastructure for commodity supply is a massive driver. Ultimately, we're going to have volatility. Commodities don't go up in straight lines indefinitely. And when growth starts to ebb, then some commodities will pull back. I think it's relevant that copper isn't going anywhere. It's been going sideways now for most of the last year. But there's certainly a sequence of higher reaction lows. And it's not like there's new copper supply just sitting out there. it takes years to develop new copper mines. And even where you already know where they are, you still have to basically build cities. Now, Afghanistan has got significant copper resources, and they're close to roads. And it's not exactly the most politically stable part of the world. So there's risks for anybody who goes in there, and that's even true for China. But there will be resource competition, and certainly there's going to be a lot of investment in new supply. So these are, I think, very significant bull market possibilities. Even though we still have these big questions in the short term about the potential for stock markets to pull back and tighter liquidity, the likelihood is that those are going to represent buying opportunities because the bigger questions here are geopolitical in nature, and central banks then just have to play catch up with the political imperative. And when we think about the trends that are on, well, banks underperforming are certainly a threat. Stock markets with type 2 top formations are a threat. Commodities doing this well this late in the cycle is a further support for the view that this is late cycle activity. But I don't think that we're going to have the kind of crash in commodities that we had in 2011. I think we're more likely to see ultimately a setback, which will create buying opportunities. And in the meantime, before a recession, and I don't anticipate a recession before 2023, we should anticipate that commodities will do exceptionally well, and that they will peak well after the stock market has been trending downwards for a while. But they won't be fully immune. They generally fall last and they fall hard, but then they will also be among the first to recover. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.